Like, what? Tell me, give me a little biopic of you. Like, where did you grow up? At what point do you recall first encountering bagpipes? I don't know. Was there music in the house when you were a kid? What did your parents think? All that kind of stuff.
Sure. Well, so I grew not so much of a musical family. Mm-hmm. My dad played in, you know, junior high, high school, and college with the University of Utah. He played cornet and trumpet and stuff that. And so I kind of he got it from him a little bit. But I started in when the kids from the junior high come to the grade school and introduce you to hey, come participate in band with us, you know, the concert band or whatever. And so they had a person that played the clarinet and oboe and stuff like that. And I just kind of gravitated to that. And so I started playing clarinet and oboe in junior high and in high school. And that was about it. After high school, never picked it up again. And to be honest, I started it, as far as bagpiping, I didn't catch on until the young age of about 37.
Really?
So, yeah.
I never would have guessed, Mike.
Yeah. Before that, I had never heard of bagpipes. I'd never seen the bagpipes, listened to them at all. And it was kind of one of those midlife crisis. I don't know if it was a midlife crisis type of thing, but just...
A midlife something.
I was midlife something. Funny thing, I always have had hobbies and needed something to occupy my time. I used to race mountain bikes and road bikes and stuff like that, and for quite a while, and started developing, I guess you'd call it, exercise-induced asthma.
Oh, shoot.
So after every training session, you know, it would just take longer and longer to recover until it would be a week, and I still couldn't breathe right type of thing.
Man.
So I had to give that up. And so I was kind of, you know, what am I going to do type of thing? I need something to do. I'm going nuts here. And it was about, I want to say 2007, probably 2006. But my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, had passed away about 10 years before that.
Mm.
And my mother-in-law invited us to every Memorial Day. We'd go and, you know, lay flowers on his gravesite and stuff. And this was up at the Bountiful Estates Cemetery here in Bountiful, if you're familiar, if you know where that is.
I don't know if I've been to that one.
It's just south of the Bountiful Temple.
Gotcha.
Up on Bountiful Boulevard there. But so apparently every year, I guess the Utah Pipe Band has a relationship with the cemetery there. I guess the founder, Dave Barkley, I believe is his name.
Yeah, the Barkley
was good friends with the proprietor there, and the Barkley family have a plot there. And so I guess the Utah Pipe Band would always come up and, you know, perform a Memorial Day program. And one year we were up there, and I saw them come up, and we didn't sit for the program or anything. I thought, that's pretty cool. Didn't think anything of it. The next year we went back up again, but we decided, well, we're going to sit down and watch and listen to it right in front. And so I sat down there and watched them strike in and come in. And as they were playing, you know, you get that, they always say something about the bagpipe, something just clicks, right?
Yeah.
And something clicked for me that day, and I was like, that is so cool. Just because I could feel the drones through the ground and everything. Just I've never experienced something like that before. It was really, really something. And so I kind of turned to my wife, and after it was over, says, I want to learn how to do that. And she kind of course rolls her eyes, and it's like, oh, great, here we go.
Another hobby. Yeah.
And who would have thought that after almost 20 years where it would come? But that's kind of essentially where it started from. And at that time, I didn't know who to talk to. I was too embarrassed to go up and talk to any of the pipers, but or the players. But I was like, I don't know anybody in bagpiping. I've never, you know, who do I contact? How do I even research, type of a thing? And so this was in the, I guess, the early stages of the internet, type of a thing, mm-hmm. where you'd kind of search and look online. And that's kind of where I started, is just, where do I go and how do I look something up like that? And yeah. so I guess, and that's kind of where it started.
It's interesting that that having exercise-induced asthma be the thing that, like, stopped the previous hobbies, that something that yeah. requires your lungs so darn much would be the next hobby.
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, the pipes, yeah, they are. They can be taxing, but not nearly as much as I had thought. So
yeah. Well, and then do you feel like, even though it had been years, your clarinet and oboe playing kind of helped with accelerating your learning process? Because I've known a few clarinet and oboe players who then came to pipes later, and it does seem like those folks tend to grab onto that fingering real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I knew how to read music. I understood music theory. Mm-hmm. I knew about tuning and how to sound good and without being out of tune and stuff. So how I found out, or what I looked up finally, is on some obscure website, I can't even remember what it was, but mm-hmm. there was a listing for John Karens had at the time was producing some instruction books with accompanying CDs. And you could buy them individually, or I think there was like seven books each, you know, progressing, you know, level 1, 2, 3 on up. He had, I don't think he ever finished them. He was supposed to be like 10 or 11 altogether, but so there was a package deal, and you got a Walsh practice chanter and everything, along with the books and everything. So I bought it for like $200 at the time, and that's kind of where I started. I just basically self-taught myself, which is the worst thing you want to have go on when you're learning, especially the bagpipes.
Yeah. So, did you have any things like I know what happens to some people. I remember Tyler Johnson telling me that when he tried to learn by himself, because, you know, looking at the diagrams, it's understandable that things get mirrored. And so he learned with his hands flipped around and then had to correct that. Did you have any big things that you had to correct once you, I don't know, got with a band or got with another instructor?
As far as like the basics of it, no. With the diagrams in the books, you know, I'm right-handed, but in looking at how it was instructed, yeah, your left hand goes on top, mm-hmm. et cetera, and just kind of go through there. And it was extremely basic, basically how to sound the notes, what each note is, the fingering chart, and just basic scales and stuff like that to start off with. And then as you progress further on, at the end of the books, you have a couple of basic tunes that you can learn and memorize. And you can follow along with John on the CD as far as playing. And so just kind of learning it that way. Mm-hmm. And then progressing from there, I bought a practice goose that you could inflate with, you know, like the bag under your arm and still with the practice chanter and stuff like that. So that's kind of how it all started. On that, but yeah, it was, I think, thankfully I understood with my music theory and background and stuff, it made it a lot simpler to learn.
Yeah. I was just talking with Hart, up in Montana about oboes a little bit, I'm under the impression that, cause like I have a sister-in-law who plays oboe, a friend who plays oboe. I'm under the impression that a lot of oboe players get really familiar with their reeds, like that it's not uncommon for an oboe player to have some equipment for reed, if not reed making, then at least serious reed maintenance. But sometimes even reed making is like not terribly uncommon, is the impression I'm under. Has that come into play for you as well? I mean, the reeds, I'm ignorant of oboe reeds other than looking at them and thinking, oh, it looks kind of like a bagpipe reed, you know? Do you feel like you have any special insight about reeds that other pipers don't have when they come to it because of your oboe playing?
Not particularly in that. As far as like reed manipulation and stuff like that, I'm still a novice, really.
Aren't we all?
I leave that to the experts.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you can order pretty much a reed however you want it at your blowing strength and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, that you can get. I know, like the Piper's Hut is where I do a lot of my business with, and you can request a specific, level of or strength of reed if you want, and
mm-hmm.
they'll pretty well to match it for you. But no, back when I first started, I was still, eyes wide open type of a thing, but I never messed with the reeds.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand.
Yeah.
In that respect.
Well, no worries. What about the, like the shift to like bagpipe tuning and stuff like that, having been familiar with concert pitch and everything, was that a hurdle to get over, or did you kind of take it in stride? No problem at all.
I would consider myself lucky in that, I hate listening to something that's out of tune.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's people singing, whether it's instruments playing, whatever, it's just, if something is off, I immediately tune to that, and it just drives me crazy. It's like, here, let me come help you with that. But, I understood about, the harmonics and the waves and stuff like that. When you're tuning, you hear the wah, wah, wah sound. Well, that's obviously not, the way it's supposed to sound.
Mm-hmm.
So, even with my, later instruction and stuff like that, my early instructors, and I've only had a couple of them, one being, Ross Morrill and then Justin Howland.
If you're only going to have a couple, that's a good couple to have.
That's a good couple to have. Yeah. But as far as, tuning on my own and stuff like that, I picked it up pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
On how to sound and how it's supposed to sound. And, I did, like I say, I did a lot of research and reading and listening. And so I became, I would call it infatuated with just, some of the pro level, the upper level players, open level players, like, your Willie McCallums and stuff like that. I just, like I say, I soaked up as much information as I could.
Yeah.
Who, on playing and everything like that. And, when I started out, just kind of say, okay, it's time to, after playing the practice chanter for about, a year or so like that, just say, okay, I want to start learning the pipes. I'm getting anxious. I want to figure this out. And so, in those early days, just who do I want to play with? I had a guy that I worked with, who played with Salt Lake Scots.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me to one of their practices to just say, hey, come listen to us and see what you think. And I had never, this was the first time ever going and listening to a band ever. And took me to, I guess they were practicing at Highland High School at the time. And it was almost walking into a secret society.
Yeah, sure.
No offense to the Scots or anything,
but
they're great. They're great people, but they're just, you're like, who is this guy? And, where is his, did you collect his offering before entering the premises,
That's one of the challenges though, for just about any band. It's like, how do you got stuff to do, right? While you're there. And so then when somebody else shows up, it's like, where's the welcoming committee? Cause if somebody's not in charge of that, it can be easy to kind of let that slip.
Yeah, exactly. It was interesting. I don't know if nothing against them or anything like that at all. It didn't fit with me,
mm-hmm.
and said, okay, well, I appreciate your assistance and I'll think about it type of a thing. And, my mother-in-law, bless her heart, she knew I was learning bagpipes and stuff. And she saw a little blurb, a little article in our local paper here just saying, you know, back, it was during the summer months where they have free workshops and classes you can take for free for the community at like the high school and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
Whether it's, you know, art classes or what have you. But there was a little article saying, you know, learn the bagpipes. And I was like, what? So it was on like a Tuesday or Wednesday evening for like 45 minutes at the high school. And so
at this point, you'd been on the chanter for like around a year and you're just ready to move.
Yeah, I'd been on the chanter for a while. Yeah. I had actually bought my first set of pipes and had no luck with them. Got frustrated, sold them. And
looking back now, do you know, were they a bad set or like an older set that was beat up or?
This will make you laugh. So, I was looking for my first set and I found on eBay, an older set of Hardys and, with the, you know, the pumpkin, you know, cattle and mounts and all that kind of stuff and a complete set. And it was like, I want to say $600 or something like that, which was a lot of money to me back then. And so I bought them and I knew how to put them together. And of course, just by reading stuff is how I learned stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Put them together, put reeds in and stuff, and started and attempted to blow them up and play them. And I was like, why is it so hard? I'm not getting any sound, you know, it keeps losing air. What's going on? Is there a leak someplace? Losing air. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. And I remember just getting so frustrated with it that I said, you know what, this maybe isn't for me. So I ended up selling them and I said, well, I'll just continue learning. Well, looking, as I look at it, I forgot that there's supposed to be a blowpipe valve.
Oh no.
That goes on the end of your blowpipe that's supposed to keep air from escaping out.
Yeah.
So I was like putting my tongue over the top of the mouthpiece to keep the air in.
Yeah.
Like this is how you're supposed to make bagpipes. This is stupid. So,
oh man.
Yeah.
Those poor pipes. They were sitting there, you know, well, you're not giving me a fair shake. You got to finish.
Exactly. And it's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So,
do you ever think about that set, Mike, that like, what if it was like somehow just like, you know, the, like fate, it was like the perfect set of pipes. And so like, you crossed paths, but it didn't come out, you know, it didn't come out in the cards as it were.
Well, it's funny, that you say that, if you basically in my band, with Wasatch, I'm kind of known as the chasing tone guy, meaning I'm the wheeler dealer. I've owned and played almost over 2 dozen sets, different sets of
two
pipes.
Two dozen?
Yeah.
Now, hang on. Let me put together the timeline here. Are we talking to like two dozen since like 2008-ish?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've bought and sold more than 2 dozen sets of different pipes just because...
I mean, I've seen a few listings from you in the last few years, you know, and so I was aware because I've also like purchased and then tried and then sold in order to get something else kind of thing, you know, and so
exactly.
I was aware that, you know, a lot of us go through that process, but two dozen, man, that's I wonder if there's some kind of record you could be holding. That's impressive.
Everybody that they just look at me says, what, another set type of a thing?
A new set every week in practice.
Exactly. It's, I don't know what it is. It's the, I've owned sets from that first set of, you know, cheap Hardy pipes to, 1895 Cocoswood David Glenn's to, pre-World War I, Henderson's to Lowry's to, Stark's, pretty much the only sets that, and the only reason I do it is, I've been fascinated by the makers of bagpiping, of bagpipes itself. It's kind of like other musicians, like they're infatuated by the old masters.
Yeah, sure. You want to see the Stradivarius or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I've always been interested. I want to hear how they sound, the tone and stuff like that. And so, yeah, right now I currently own two sets, but I own, two sets of Ross Morrill's, pipes,
man, he makes what I'm on right now.
And if you've been on his website lately, the latest set that he's posted is mine.
Oh, really? So, I know exactly which set that is. I was just drooling over it. I think it was just yesterday. He'd put up some photos of it and a video of him playing. It's got some amazing wood grain in it, just like that twisty wood grain right up the. Is it? Yeah, that's your set, huh? That's pretty.
Yeah,
cool.
That's my set. That's my set.
I mean, so, everything I've ever seen him make is beautiful. But like, I definitely had thought to myself, like, wow, that might be the prettiest set yet, just thanks to the wood. Yeah. You know, the wood grain was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I have a unique relationship with Ross. I call myself his unpaid marketing executive on it.
Oh, yeah.
This is the sixth set of his.
Oh, wow.
Owned. And so,
so you're just the first stop for his pipes.
Exactly. And most of his pipes that I've played and sold are now back east with pipers and stuff. And so that's kind of how his reputation has grown
via my page
in a small part to me.
That's
so,
funny. Oh,
but,
that's funny.
No, Ross is fantastic and his pipes are, I would put him up against any maker in the world right now. The pipes, the ones that we're talking about that I own now, I picked out the wood for them. So I bought all the wood, and I designed the drone profile on the outside. So it's all my design, which is really cool. That's why I like Ross so much is his, he's like, you know, whatever you want to do, I'll make it type of a thing.
Yeah.
If it's feasible. And so, yeah, it from his workmanship to the tone produced to, you know, no other maker in the world does what he does with the wood. So
yeah. I love seeing the sets of me when he posts them for sure. That's really cool. Have you ever thought about like turning it professional, Mike, like and just becoming like a distributor of bagpipes, you know, like just get
get
makers from all over the world to send you sets and then you could just try them out and sell them.
Yeah, I wish that would be really, really a cool side gig, I think. I don't know if I'd make any money on it, but it would certainly be a bucket list thing just to play some of these incredible sets and pass them along.
Do you feel like then having done, I mean, over two dozen sets, you know, at this point, do you feel like you've got a pretty good ear and feel for the differences across time as well as from maker to maker, or do you still feel like there's so much variation from one set to the next set that it could be hard to, to be clear, Mike, I'm speaking from the perspective of like, I've moved multiple sets of small pipes through my hands and just a couple sets of Highland pipes, but the main set of Highland pipes that I still play is the first set that I got. So I'm kind of on the other end of the spectrum. I mean, I use the same set of drone reeds for like almost 20 years, you know? And so I really don't have a feel for what the different makers and different time periods offer. So I'm just curious, do you feel like you've now developed kind of a sense for that?
I would like to say yes. I have a set of drone reeds that I've played across almost all of the sets that produce, I think, the best, tone to, at least to my ear. And I've gotten feedback from judges when I've played, that have always complimented me on my tuning, on my drone sound. I guess one of the biggest feathers in my cap we competed at Chicago last year, I believe, and I won. My pipes were pipe of the day.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
As far as not so much winning everything, but just overall tone and my sound in my category, or my, I just want to call it my, against those I was competing against.
Sure. Yeah.
The judge is like that. You had simply the best sounding pipe I've heard all day. So congratulations to you.
That's really
not
cool.
Bragging or anything like that, but I chalk that up to just understanding the instrument
Was that one of Ross's sets that you were playing, by the way?
It was.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was. So,
but I interrupted you. Sorry, you chalked that up to.
No, you're okay. But as far as, you know, from maker to maker, just in, of course, reading and the history of the makers and the pipes and the sounds they produce and things like that. Just, for example, like, you know, the David Glenn set that I have, it was a mix of, you know, Colchis wood and ebony, probably the two premier tonal woods that you can have for pipes. But of course, they're the most susceptible to cracking and issues that way. But just, it was extremely warm, extremely rich, not overpowering, just a very, very warm sound as compared to, say, like the 1920s Colchis Hendersons that I had owned. Very just a bold, you know, almost in your face type of a sound. Just little nuances between the makers and the sounds that they make between the makers and stuff is just fascinating to me. I've always been interested. I've always been searching for that sound, you know, and I know certain players have a signature sound based on the pipes that they play. Like, for example, Roddy McLeod, he's who I envy and idolize as far as his drone sound and his playing. I don't know. It's just something unique that I've always looked at and chased and wanted to emulate and stuff. Of course, I fail miserably most of the time, but I just love the sound that it produces and the harmonics that come off the chanter. A friend of mine, Johnny Miner, if you know who he is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Johnny and I are good friends, absolutely.
He's been away from the band for a while, but he and I would always talk pipes and always talk tone and always talk makers and players and stuff like that. And so just, you know, one of those things, you know, what if we had this type of set? And so I've been fortunate enough to be able to purchase them. Basically, one set pays for the next set type of thing.
Yeah.
So
I suspect that that's like a thing for a lot of us, is that like over the years we've rolled enough money into whatever we have that it can roll on to whatever we do next.
So it, go ahead.
Well, I sure don't want to interrupt you if you have any other lingering thoughts. I was just curious if you feel like at this point you've got an appetite for the sampling experience. And so, like, imagining that, like, say you do get the set that gives you exactly the perfect sound that you're looking for, you know, like it's just right. Do you think you might then still have an itch to, you know, like having developed something of a habit for, I mean, 2 dozen sets, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I almost want to say I've developed a bad habit.
There are worse habits you could have, of course, but.
A lot of my friends just say, you just need to settle with one set and just because how are you going to be able to become a better player is if you keep selling things and, you know, never settling on one thing. And it's like, well, I've kind of learned how to manipulate it a bit and work with what I have. For example, the set that I currently have, I'm still breaking them in.
I wonder if you might be like the most proficient human on the planet at getting a new set of pipes set up. You know, like, I hadn't thought of that before, Mike, but it's like, I've helped a couple students set up sets, you know, here and there, but I don't think I'd add between things that I've had and things I've helped other people set up, I don't think it would add up to 2 dozen, you know? There's a skill set there, and I don't know, Mike. I'm not meaning to disagree with people that we probably both know and everything, but it does occur to me that, like, okay, well, maybe this is silly, but I've heard people before, like, criticize musicians who read sheet music. The people doing the criticizing learn by ear, and they'll say something like, "Oh, you can't play a tune well until you've like really got it into your bones. Like, you know it so well that you don't need music. So if you're looking at music, you know, you don't really know the tune. But from the other side, and I suspect you also know, I know I don't read music that proficiently myself, but I know people who read it so well that their eyes are 8 bars ahead of where their fingers are. And so I suspect that that criticism is coming from a place where the person, that person who's speaking, who's doing the criticizing, doesn't read music very well. And so they're imagining that that is how slow and cumbersome reading music is for everybody. Whereas the person who's reading music very proficiently, it's not slow and cumbersome. It flows just fine. And I wonder if, like, for me, the idea of setting up another set of pipes definitely sounds daunting. If I thought to myself, okay, tomorrow I'm going to sell the set of pipes that I've been playing for over 20 years now and start with a fresh set, there's a lot of stuff that I have not had to do since I was a 14, 15 year old kid, you know?
Right.
I have not developed those skills, but I mean, you definitely have. And so it might seem nonsensical to me to be like, why would you get another set? You got to settle into the set you have, but that's just because that's the way I play the pipes. You are probably really good at and very efficient at getting a set of pipes set up and ready to go.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Mm-hmm. It's taken, it, of course, you know, it's taken me this long and I'll always continue to try to figure out and understand this crazy instrument that we love. But in setting up an instrument, I already have, like you were mentioning, you know, I can think, you know, 8 bars ahead on how I want the setup to go, how I want the tuning to be, how the reed should be set, blowing strength, all that kind of stuff. It's been a lot of trial and error and experimentation. I've probably owned just as many different sets of drone reeds, just again chasing that sound and that tone that I want to generate. Everyone always says, well, they always want to compare to cane reeds because cane is supposed to be the, you know, the epitome of what a bagpipe, you know, epitome of bagpipe tone is through cane reeds.
Sure.
Well, I've tried cane reeds and I don't like them.
Hot take from Mike.
Yeah. I don't care for the cane. It could be just the climate that we live in here in Utah.
Sure.
Is so dry and we're at elevation and stuff. Maybe if I live back east or in Scotland or someplace that was a lot more humid and stuff, but that was just kind of one of those things that I didn't want to chase and mess with because I was, I don't know if you want to call it, I was in a hurry to find the tone that I wanted.
Mm.
And, the synthetic reeds now are so good today that, and they're so air efficient and their ease of setup, is by far, what I look for. And and I finally settled on, a set that, produces what I wanted. I don't think I'll ever change. That's what I use for every set that I play now. So.
Oh, cool. So that's interesting. Cause I could imagine that like the sort of like comparing different sets of pipes to one another, the pairing of reeds with those pipes of course is going to play a factor. So like having found the right set of reeds now from one set of pipes to the next, it's more of an apples to apples thing with a consistent reed set, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Is that a secret you'll take to your grave, or do you mind nerding out on a kit with
more?
Yeah. What's your reed setup?
Sure. So my favorite of all time bass reed is a Kinnaird Evolution.
Oh, sure.
It's just, some people say it's a bit too buzzy. I don't see that.
I actually really like the buzz, especially in a bass. That's kind of the profile I'm drawn to. So I'm all for that.
What I look for is just more of a kind of a deep thrum type of a sounding bass to it that is extremely steady. And I've never experienced it with any other bass reed other than the Kinnaird Evo. It strikes in perfectly every time. It never roars. It's always been air efficient. It's super easy to adjust, and it locks in every time. The tenor reeds that I use for my for one of my sets, I use the new Balanced Tone High Resonance by Bruce Hitchings. For the bores that I have in one of my sets, they have by Ross. They're based off of his dad's Atherton McDougall bores, and so they sound very. They're not bright. They're not too bright. They're just a bit. Like I say, when I say bright, they're not. The harmonics aren't crazy where you're always trying to figure out where the sweet spot is with them. So they lock in extremely well, and they just, the blend is very, very nice. And then in my new set, they're Ross's signature bore, which is a kind of a hybrid. It's a, the bass is from a set of 1910 Hendersons, and the tenors are from a set of pre-1900 Glens. And so it's a bit, it's an interesting combination of the two, but the blend between both of them is just absolutely stunning. So the I use Selby tenors in my latest set, and so they just provide a really, really nice ring over the top.
And, there, and then is the, that with the same Kinnaird bass?
Yeah. So I have two Kinnaird reeds, two Kinnaird bass reeds, one for each set. Instead of trying to, you know, switch back and forth, it just makes it easier if I just have the same read for one for each, and that way it's, I can tune it how I want. But that's my secret combo. And I've never had a bad comment from a judge on any of my sound. I've always first thing I've always mentioned on my score sheets is beautiful drone sound, you know. So and they've always locked in. They don't move. They stay where they're supposed to. And so that takes practice. I put that up to practice too. So
yeah, you gotta play them. You can't just be just moving them around, huh? Do you feel like, Mike? I wonder about this. This isn't something that I know about, but I sometimes wonder. It's like, it's kind of like those moments when you look in the mirror and you think to yourself, like, wait a second, are mirrors actually showing me the accurate? Like, do I actually look like that? You know, like, or like, is the color that I think I'm seeing also what my, this other person is seeing, you know, that kind of stuff. I always wonder, I don't always wonder, but sometimes I wonder if what I'm hearing while playing the pipes is comparable to what someone would hear from a distance, you know, in terms of tone and even tuning and stuff like that, you know, like, because every once in a while I've heard recordings of myself where, like, maybe I thought I was locked in, but in the recording from 10 feet away, I'm like, oh, no, I wasn't actually, you know? So, like, when you're chasing tone, you know, is it exclusively based on what the pipes sound like while playing them? Or are you capturing recordings from a distance and seeing what it'll sound like for judges and stuff like that as well?
I would say both. Recently, I've been recording myself a lot more, and like you're saying, I do find some nuances a little bit. It's like, okay, I think I'm locked in. I can feel that I'm locked in, you know, up close and personal with the pipes and stuff. But then, going back and listening to it, it's just, I'm just a touch out there, type of a thing. I think it just all comes down to preparation and, of course, how well you know your pipe. And I'm hands-on with my pipes pretty much every single day, which I think most players are, but just trying to tweak things here and there. I don't, once I'm set, I don't really touch it in terms of the setup goes, but when I'm playing, that when I'm recording or when I'm playing for judges and stuff like that, I get a little bit of, you get the outside world coming in and say, okay, well, maybe I'm not, you get that little bit of that self-doubt going on when you're playing.
Yeah.
And I definitely have suffered from anxiety issues when playing and competing.
Mm.
I even at one time, a few years back, I was in the grade three band with Wasatch, and just having an awful run with the band section, because we were progressing so fast as a band in terms of musicality and playing ability and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I had just maybe less than 5 years before that, it came from nothing, self-taught type of thing, with hardly any instruction. So yeah, it was just one of those, the self-doubt creeps in, and you're wondering, do I sound really good? Do I not sound good? And then your fingers start to tighten up, and then, you know, just, it kind of goes downhill from there.
Yes, absolutely. Have you ever, like, with exploring different makers and stuff like that, have you ever been drawn to the idea of maybe getting a lathe someday and trying your hand at turning some wood?
Well, to say that I haven't would be a lie. Yes, I would love to be, you know, in a perfect world, I'd love to just, you know, have my own little workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And turning pipes and making instruments and stuff. But that quickly goes out the window on that. I'll leave that to the experts that know what they're doing on mm-hmm. that. I'll play their pipes, but I don't think I could ever make a set of pipes.
Well, surely the world requires both. You know, what's the maker going to do if there aren't people to play their pipes? And maybe especially an appreciator, a connoisseur, as it were, you know, who can appreciate the nuances between the pipes. So, was there any point, Mike, along that early journey, that first year, like maybe that point, the point at which you decided, like, all right, it's time to get pipes, that, like, people around you, you know, maybe your spouse, maybe kids or neighbors or anything like that, did they ever express, like, surprise that you were still, you're still doing that? You know what I mean? Like, it didn't fizzle out?
Yeah, they were my wife, you know, bless her heart, has always been supportive of me. In whatever I do and stuff. To kind of go back to what I was talking about earlier with this, you know, little class, the gentleman that was teaching it, his name was Leland Morrill, and whose brother is Andrew Morrill, if you know who he is. And so I said, well, he says, you already know what you're doing. You're playing everything correctly, and you're way ahead of everybody else in the class. Hey, do you have an instructor, or are you with a band? It's like, no, I'm looking to play with somebody. You know, who do you play with? And he said, I play with Wasatch, Wasatch and District. And I said, where do you guys play at? We play here at the Bountiful High on Thursday nights. I says, you're kidding.
Is it like way closer for you too?
Yeah, I mean, it's not 2 minutes away from my house.
Yeah.
And so, he says, yeah, well, let me get you in contact with our band manager. Her name is, at the time, Megan McDonald was our band manager, and mm-hmm. he gave me her email, and I messaged her that night, and she says, come out this Thursday. We start at like 6 or 7 or something like that, and I'll introduce you to everybody. And it's like, okay, that was quick. So...
You must have been too, Mike, like somebody who's like even self-taught, like through initiative, like learned so much already to just be like, I'm ready to play. Just show up, you know, like that. You got to be like that's a dream event for any band, I'm sure, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm sure she was excited.
she was fantastic. And she's still with us to this day. And mm-hmm. I play with her now in the grade two. I showed up. At the time, we had a grade four and a grade three, and the grade three was already rehearsing, so she put me with the grade fours, and just kind of watched and listened. One of my best friends now, Mark Pekkanen, kind of introduced himself to me, and this was in the middle of the season, so it was in the summertime, so they were already in, you know, full swing. This, I think, was 2008, mm-hmm. I want to say, or 2009. And just listening to them play, was just enthralling to me. I was just like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
And says, yeah, come out. Or, you know, if you have pipes, you know, come out and play. And we'll get you introduced to everybody and get you the get you the music and stuff like that, so you can start learning. And so, kind of from there, it's just onto the races type of a thing. And so, that next year, 2009 was kind of just a learning year for me, with a grade four, first competitions and stuff like that. And then 2010, still with a grade four. And by that time I progressed quite a bit, especially with my instructors, with Justin and Ross, helping me along the way. And, I was able to, they said, you need to compete solo so you can, be a benefit to you as a player, and to help, of course, help turn, transitions to band.
Yeah.
Is a lot, makes you a better player in the band setting if you solo. And, I was, fortunate enough to, win aggregate Piper of the Year in grade four,
right off the bat, 2010. That's great.
Yeah, I was totally blown away. That was, I guess it was more of my, once, and my wife tells me this, once I get something in my sights, I put, it's kind of like you put blinders on, and that's all I focus on.
Yeah.
And sometimes to the detriment of other things.
Yeah.
But I was focused. I had a goal in mind, what I wanted to do. And after that season, Ross came and stole me away to the grade three, and rest is history type of a thing. So,
well, I mean, to that point, Mike, like you, excuse me, you, it does seem like a fast, progression through the competitive grades, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, like, congrats, that's awesome. You know, I wonder, do you feel like, I don't mean, let's see, I'm trying to figure out how to say this in a way that I don't mean this at all to seem like I'm saying that you were ignorant at the beginning of your journey,
no,
but rather like, if you had been aware of what was ahead in those early years, would it have been intimidating? And do you think like there, so then could there be some benefit to being like somewhat ignorant to like the world of competitive bagpiping, where it's like you step in and be like, and they say, well, there's the grade four band. And then before you know it, they say, why don't you play with the grade three band? And like, maybe there's not a whole lot of baggage tied up in your head already with like, oh my gosh, that's stressful. You know, you can just, you'd be like, oh, okay, I guess that's what we're doing now, you know, or even solos, to have your instructors be like, you should solo. If you don't have baggage in your head about soloing being stressful, you can just be like, okay, I'll solo. You know what I mean? Does that come into play at all, do you feel?
I think in the early time, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of like, okay, this is what we're doing now type of a thing.
Yeah.
And I had, in my high school days and stuff, I played with our high school marching band. So I was used to competition. I was used to playing under stressful situations, competing against other bands, on the biggest stages. We played, with, at Rice Eccles Stadium.
Oh yeah.
With a couple of thousand people in the stands against other, other high school bands where you're marching and you're creating formations on the field while playing.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff, and just the adrenaline rush that you get with that and stuff. So and along with my racing bikes and stuff like that, so I understand stress and I understand competitive environments and what's expected and personal preparation on stuff like that. So I think I was my eyes were wide open when I was going into it.
Yeah.
I think as I progressed, especially with grade three, the level of expectation placed on each individual person was significantly more.
Yeah.
And so I think that caused a bit of consternation in me and stress levels as far as rising that way, because I'd never played at that level before, and the level of music and everything like that, just, I think I maybe reached a plateau maybe. And so trying to break through that plateau was what was causing me a lot of stress at that time and stuff. And so I want to say a couple of years after that, I went back down to the grade four to kind of get a refresher, I guess, if you will. And this was, I want to say, 2017, 2018, 2019 era type thing like that, mm-hmm. where we had a lot of success in the grade four when I was playing with them. And this is just right before COVID hit. We were doing really well. And then they upgraded us to grade three, and then COVID hit.
Mm.
And meaning they upgraded the grade four band to a grade three. And then COVID hit, and this kind of things kind of went crazy. And so I had stepped away from the band from that for a year or two after that, just, you know, personal things, other things going on, things like that. And mm-hmm. then decided, well, I'm going to get back into it. The grade three was still going on, but the organization of it all wasn't very good. And it's like, well, I don't want to play with the grade four. I want to make it to grade two, which is the grade three had been upgraded to a grade two status a couple of years back. And that was my primary goal going back into the band, is I want to make grade two.
Mm.
And so, during those early COVID years, 2020, 2021, I just pretty much dedicated myself to learning the music, to getting back up to speed, and, got an instructor again with Ross, and, started, you know, going at it full tilt, and was lucky enough to be invited to up to grade two.
Yeah.
About 4 years ago. So
I remember when Mike Swan started playing with the grade two there, and he was mm-hmm. telling me about how much music he was learning, you know?
Yeah.
So much music. I just,
yeah, he and I had actually tried out together for grade two, and he made it and I didn't. And so that's kind of what lit a fire.
That's where the rivalry began.
Yeah.
There can be only one Mike.
Yep. And of course I stand next to him in the circle. So we always elbow each other every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. But that does blow my mind. I mean, I've had a pretty leisurely experience with piping myself. I've never really, I can't think of any time that I haven't like had more than maybe three tunes in front of me that needed to be learned that year. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit curious about your take on that experience as well, Mike, because it seems like maybe it could even be analogous to trying a lot of different sets of pipes. Like when you have to learn a lot of music all the time, like I've got to imagine you must either already be in possession of or pretty quickly develop some good strategies for learning tunes. Getting them under your wing quickly. That's not what I'm trying to say, but you know, get them in your bones quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you can put a finger on what helps you when you've got a giant stack of new tunes to learn? Or is it something that you just kind of have to feel out every time?
No, for me, it's a lot of, I don't want to let my friends down,
mm-hmm.
In terms of, I want to be as prepared as possible. And I, for example, this year we have a brand new medley that we just, we're starting at, we've already played it. We already competed with it a couple of times this year. It's just, some people can learn music, you know, at a drop of a hat, and they look at it, you know, twice and they got it down.
Yeah.
It takes me a while, not a long time, but I have to have some sit down time and just going through the tune, each tune, you know, dedicate time to each tune every day.
Mm.
I can learn music pretty quickly. If I can recognize, I can usually recognize patterns in music, in terms of, you know, phrases repeating themselves or, you know, this line is similar to this line, except for maybe two bars type of a thing. So I can pick up patterns in music pretty quickly and, kind of store them away and, I can, it just takes me a little bit, sometimes a little bit longer, depending on what it is. But if it's, but I usually pick up new music pretty quickly. And mainly it's just more of a motivation factor that, okay, Ross, he wants, okay, we need this tune memorized by, you know, in 2 weeks by next rehearsal or something like that. So, I just, you know, put it in my head that, okay, I want to be this type of a player. I want to be as proficient on the pipes as I can be. Ross, put me up to on the front line a couple of years ago, and I want to stay on the front line. So, cause that's kind of, I always say the front line of a pipe band is your, that's the kind of the face of the band is those people that are on the front.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you don't want to mess, don't want to mess up, when you're marching into the circle. So that just puts a little bit more, motivation, for me to learn it.
That's interesting. I've come across the wisdom, you know, that like people will say, like, if you want to get better at a thing or if you want to learn a thing, give yourself a reason to, meaning like give yourself a deadline, you know, set up some kind of a performance or a delivery date, you know, something that's going to like, you know, it makes it so you can't just be like, oh, I'm going to get to that someday. It kind of forces you to kind of buckle down and get stuff done. Do you feel like you maybe like even consciously, like with the motivation to stay on the front line, for example, are you like consciously putting that into like putting that idea to work for you?
I try to. I don't want to be that weak link, in the wheel or in the machine that causes it to break.
Be the bad mic. You got to be the good mic, right?
I got to be the good mic. Yes. And we have, there's like four guys in our band with the name Mike.
Oh, so, are there?
Yeah. Actually, there's three pipers that in our grade two that are Mike.
Oh, so you got to be the best Mike then.
I've got to be the best Mike. So no offense, Swan, but you know, I'm better than you. No, just kidding. No, it's, I take things very hard, personal on myself in terms of a bad performance or something like that.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, something could have happened on the other side of the circle or what have you. But, I just take things, more personally, maybe than I should. And so I'm very, very hard on myself when it comes to, trying to do a good performance and not messing up, especially in the heat of the moment when we're competing.
Yeah.
And, you got judges standing, you know, 2 feet behind you and you know that they're right behind you and you're like, okay, please don't screw up. And then inevitably something goes wrong.
Don't screw up is of course like what triggers you screwing up, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And Ross is, you know, beat it into us time and time again. Just, you know, the music, just play it, you know? So it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, Mike, like that's kind of like, of course, I'm not saying that like the work doesn't translate into fun, but like, that's kind of like the work side of piping. I wonder if, kind of as we head toward a perhaps graceful close, if on the fun side of piping more explicitly, perhaps if you have any suggestions or recommendations for some of your favorite pipers, groups, et cetera, to listen to that, you know, whether it's your favorite album of all time or just maybe a piper that you're interested in listening to lately or anything like that. What's kind of top of your rotation for enjoying piping, you know, sitting back and relaxing into it?
Sure. Going back to a friend of mine, Mark Pekkanen, he and I, have always talked piping, even when I started with him, and he introduced me to, some of the greatest pipers out there, like the Jack Lees and the Willie McCallums, the Stuart Littles, and we always, every year, when the worlds come, we always have a kind of an online jargon that we go back and forth with each other, critiquing bands as they're going on. But one of the funnest things that we do is when we always, when the Glenfiddich championship comes on in October. Just sitting back and listening to just the best pipers in the world, you know, perform the art. And just, we have a group of friends that we'll have a chat with, as we're listening, and, just have a rolling commentary as, and pretend that we're critiquing these best players who,
imagine you are the judges who are sitting in front of
me. Imagine I'm the judges. Like, I have nothing to say. This guy's, he wins, you know, or this person wins. Can't they just all tie and get the same trophy?
Give them all trophies. Yeah.
So, and that's kind of where my love of piping really blossomed, is just listening to these otherworldly, musicians just perform, this art on an instrument that really a very select few people get the opportunity to play, or let alone master and enjoy. And just listening to the sound of the pipes, the drones, the playability of the musician, and just kind of, you know, what a cool instrument that, that I've discovered, and I'll play it until I'm no longer able to. So,
and that's the next thing, right, Mike, is, what will be the next hobby? Right.
I don't think I'll have any more hobbies. Piping
this will carry you through, huh?
This will carry me through. Yeah. I think that, being one of the few, technically a few people in the world that, you know, you and I, can experience something like this instrument provides, a lot of people, just look at it in awe and wonder, you know, how is this making this type of a sound, and why is it doing this to me? Why am I feeling this way?
You know,
from an instrument that shouldn't be able to do something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's a beautiful thing. It's one that I think I'll keep chasing, that proverbial tone that's out there that, it just makes it fun for me.
Yeah.